Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Sean Willens, who's the Dayton Stockton Professor of History and Director of the Program in American Studies at Princeton University. He received his PhD in History at Yale University, and his most recent book is The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, published in 2005, which won the Bancroft Prize and was a finalist for the Pulitzer. He has written some 200 articles, reviews, and op-ed pieces for numerous publications, and in 2006 he wrote an article about the George W. Bush presidency titled The Worst President in History, which appeared in Rolling Stone magazine. Willens has been a prominent supporter of the presidential candidacy of Senator Hillary Clinton, and we'll be talking to him about how Senator Hillary Clinton would fare in the general election compared to Barack Obama in terms of the Electoral College. And we'll also talk about the Pope's visit with Francis Kissling, who's a former president of Catholics for Free Choice, an independent organization of progressive Catholics based in Washington, D.C. Under Ms. Kissling's leadership, CFFC has become a leading force for change on gender, sexuality, and reproduction issues. She was described in Ms. Magazine as a woman who makes the Vatican sweat. And she's currently a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies at Harvard University, where she is also writing a book, How to Think About Abortion, Pro-Choice Reflections on Rights and Responsibilities. And she's also a supporter of Senator Barack Obama. And then in the third section, so there's a little bit of the fair and balance there. And in the third section, we'll hear from Martin Wells, who is the editor of the monthly investigative journal Noseweek in Cape Town, South Africa. He broke the story about an arms shipment, a Chinese arms shipment to Zimbabwe that was the South African dock workers refused to unload. And we talked to him about politics in South Africa as more and more pressure is being put on the South African leadership to get off the dime in terms of the tragedy next door in Zimbabwe. I'm now speaking with Sean Willens, who's a Dayton Stockton Professor of History and the Director of the Program in American Studies at Princeton University. He received his PhD in History from Yale University. He's the author of a number of award-winning books on history, including Chance Democratic, recently published, and In the Kingdom of Matthias, The Key of Liberty, and others. His most recent book is The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, published in 2005, which won the Bancroft Prize and was a finalist for the Pulitzer. He's written some 200 articles, reviews, and op-ed pieces for publications such as the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, New York Review of Books, London Review of Books, The American Scholar, The Nation, Le Monde, and Salon. He's a contributing editor to The New Republic, and he's also the historian in residence at bobdylan.com, the official Bob Dylan website. And in 2006, he wrote an article about George W. Bush's presidency titled The Worst President in History, which appeared in Rolling Stone magazine. And he's also a prominent supporter of the presidential candidacy of Senator Hillary Clinton. And Sean Willens, just I think on Friday, the head of the Democratic Party, Howard Dean, made a very impassioned speech to the delegates, the superdelegates, saying it's time to get off the dime right away. You've got to do this right away. So what is going on here? Is this going to basically get everybody focused? I mean, I can't imagine the superdelegates are going to all make their choices until after the Tuesday election in Pennsylvania.
Yes, and good morning, Ian.
Good morning.
I didn't hear Howard Dean's speech, but I think the superdelegates are going to wait and see what happens, certainly in Pennsylvania and possibly the week after. You know, these are the it's sort of an inapt name. These are the party professionals. I mean, these are the people who are have the electability issue foremost in their minds, and they're not going to rush to judgment, I don't believe.
Well, he was pretty passionate about it, and he's basically saying, "Look, you got to get off the dime, otherwise we're going to have a train wreck here."
The Democrats may have a train wreck anyway, but that's and Howard Dean can't control that. In fact, he could have done a lot to prevent it, but that's another matter. That has to do with Florida and Michigan. But quite apart from that, look, the sudden idea that the presidential candidates ought to be nominated quickly, even when there's a bitter contest, it doesn't accord with history. I mean, we've had plenty of cases in American history, even in recent history, where nominations haven't been decided until June. Why we have this has to all be wrapped up in April and people have to make up their minds right away strikes me as pointless. Either, you know, the Democrats are either going to unite or they're not. I don't think that. I think, in fact, if you try to rush to judgment on one side or the other, is going to feel pretty shortchanged, and will probably do more to make it likely that people won't unite. So I don't think it's a pretty. I don't think it's a very good idea at all.
Well, I think the conventional wisdom, at least this has certainly been stated often by Senator Obama, is that there's some doubt as to whether his people will vote for Hillary, but conversely, there's less doubt that her people would vote for him.
Yeah, well, I've read different polls about that. I've read it the other way around. You know, look, there's a long way to go between now and November. We'll see what happens. Much depends on what John McCain does and says. Much depends on a lot of different factors. So I wouldn't want to predict one way or the other right now. That's premature. What we do know is that there is a spirited contest for the Democratic nomination, and it ought to go forward until it's completed. That's why we have all of these primaries. We do have a fluky year, there's no question about it, but that has to do with a system, I think, that was very poorly designed. We only understand how poorly designed it is after the fact. That's just the way it is, but it is poorly designed. Nevertheless, we have to go through to the end of it.
So you believe that the primary system should be on a winner-take-all basis as opposed to apportioned by the vote?
Yeah, I'll make a baseball analogy. I know you're British, Ian, but I'll... for your
No, Australian, but...
Australian. Well, yeah, maybe...
It's
a baseball analogy. It's as if, you know, you've got two leagues in baseball and they square off in the fall in a World Series, right? And if you had one league that was playing by very, very different rules than what the ones that would hold in the general election, they would be at a great disadvantage. That's what's happened to the Democratic Party. They are playing by rules, including caucuses, open primaries, all the rest of it. It's not so much that they're different from the Republicans, it's just that it's not the way in which we're going to be voting in November. And so, you know, you put yourself immediately at a disadvantage by following that different set of rules.
And you argue that if Senator Hillary Clinton would have a commanding lead in the delegate count, if it were a winner-take-all.
It depends on how you look at it. But, you know, she would certainly not, you know, the dynamic would be such that she would look like a more certain nominee than not. Part of that has to do with, you know, the numbers are counted in odd ways. The delegate lead that Senator Obama currently has would certainly melt to next to nothing. And then you start looking at other factors. I mean, the most important factor in terms of electability, it seems to me at the moment, based, again, historically, is who does well in those big states that Democrats have to carry in order to break through the Republican, what are fairly secure Republican states. And those states recently have been Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, New Jersey to a certain extent, and Michigan. And I don't see anybody thinking that Obama will necessarily win any of those states. I think that Clinton would do much better. So on that score, people would have to take that into account much more. The fact is, of all the major big states, Senator Obama has won only one of them, and that's his home state of Illinois.
With Sean Willis, we're talking about his feeling that Hillary Clinton would do much better in the Electoral College in a general election than Barack Obama would. And just in terms of her, the states that Obama's won, where a lot of his delegates come from, are, as you point out, in 2004, the Democrats lost most of these states. Mm-hmm. But why, therefore, does it mean that Obama wouldn't be able to carry the big states? I mean, if they're solidly Democratic, aren't they going to go with the Democratic nominee, no matter whether it's Obama or Clinton?
Some of them certainly would. I mean, I would expect Senator Obama to carry certainly New York and California. But it's the swing states that are the big question mark, and those are states that where he's lost in the primary. I don't believe, now I can check my facts on this, But I don't believe, for example, that in the state of Ohio, since the primary rules have been changed in 1972, that anybody who lost the Democratic primary in the state of Ohio went on to win the presidency. That's just one of them. Pennsylvania is key. Clinton carried that. Bill Clinton carried that both times. I'm not so sure that Obama can carry it. And Michigan is key. And here's where the Howard Dean factor comes in. I mean, having effectively disenfranchised Michigan's Democratic voters from participating in selecting the candidate, the Democratic candidate then has to go to Michigan and say, vote for me. Well, I'm not so sure that that's going to play out very well.
Well, both the Michigan and Florida mess have sort of different fingerprints on them, don't they? I mean, I think weren't some of the political leaders in Michigan responsible for pushing this through? They were duly warned, were they not? Both Florida and Michigan by the party that they'd be disenfranchising themselves. And in the case of Florida, I understand it was the Republican governor,
Republicans, yes,
yeah, who pushed it and perhaps was doing so out of mischief.
But look, this is still an arbitrary decision made by the DNC. I mean, you know, what the dates are going to be, what the dates are not going to be, and to have that kind of penalty where you're removing all of their delegates strikes me as disenfranchisement on its face, regardless of what the parties may say or the party leadership may want to do. Ultimately, you have a responsibility to the voters of the states, of those respective states. Florida is particularly ironic given what happened in 2000. So I think that it was a draconian decision that did not necessarily have the interests of the voters of those states, best interests of those voters of those states, in mind. You know, you don't, if you're trying to win the presidency, you don't go about nominating a candidate by leaving out two very, very important swing states from the nominating process. You find a way to include them. Now, and since then, I mean, there have been proposals made, and the DNC has gone forward with this, and this is very important to recognize, Ian, that in both cases, the DNC has allowed, and there have been people in Michigan and in Florida, allowed for some kind of revote. I mean, obviously, Senator Obama wouldn't want to accept the votes that were already there because they went against him. But there have been proposals put forward to recast those votes, hold those primaries over again. In both cases, representatives of Senator Obama have blocked that possibility. In Michigan, by basically saying getting in the legislature, preventing the legislation from going forward that would enable it, and in Florida, claiming that it would be a violation of the Voting Rights Act, which I find difficult to understand. But in any case, his people have opposed a revote. Again, that's not going to look too good when it comes forward in November if he gets the nomination, because he looks as if he was trying to keep those states from having a say in the nomination process.
But Sean Willett, surely something's going to happen in Denver in August about Michigan and Florida, no matter how much the party bosses and elders and whatever you want to call them try to avoid a confrontation. It's going to come up, surely, and is there a fair way out? I mean, what do you do? Because obviously the original votes aren't fair, because the Democrats were discouraged from voting by their own party, and those that did may not represent the electorate accurately, and a do-over, apparently, nobody wants to pay for it, and they had a squabble over that. So I'm just, is there a fair way?
Well, I think the fairest way would have been to find a way to do a revote, and there was a possibility to do that, and in both cases it was squelched. That's too bad. At this point, I think it's a mess. I mean, I don't see how you're going to be able to solve it easily at all, especially if it's unclear after all the primaries are done, which is indeed a possibility, that the nomination is still not decided. I mean, both of these candidates are going to need superdelegates to get the majority, no matter what happens. To get the required majority, both whether Michigan and Florida are in or not, you're going to have to. They're both going to have to rely on superdelegates. This is just a terrible, terrible mess that could have been avoided if the leadership of the Democratic Party had acted differently.
So what? Do you think it's going to happen? I know you're not a fortune teller.
I have no idea. Right. I'll tell you this. First of all, every time I predict anything, it's wrong anyway. I mean, I've learned that over the years. But this election year has been the More predictions have gone off to die, unseemly deaths than in any other one I've seen recently. It's been a wacky political year. I frankly don't know what's going to happen, and I'm taking it, almost week by week. So the next thing to see is what happens on Tuesday, and if Obama were to win, Senator Obama to win the Pennsylvania primary, then I think that Hillary Clinton would have to think long and hard about whether to go on or not. If she wins it, and especially if she wins it by a convincing margin, then I think the thing goes on, and we just have to take it week by week. That's the only way I can think about it. I can't think beyond next Tuesday.
Well, it does seem that Hillary Clinton's superdelegate count is eroding by day. I mean, that's the stories one reads. There's an article in Sunday's New York Times about it.
That article was interesting because most of the superdelegates they were talking about were people who had defected a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know how to read that story quite. I mean, there was a woman up in Minnesota, was it, who Chelsea
tried to
yeah.
lobby.
But we got a long way to go before the superdelegates are going to shift one way or the other in any kind of decisive way, and that's why I think most of them are not choosing. I mean, let's just play the game out. I don't see there's any odds to making it to shortening it. If you shorten it one way or the other, and at this point I suppose shortening it would be in the best interest of Senator Obama, then you really do run the risk of alienating Clinton supporters because they weren't even given a fair chance.
Well, obviously,
in other words, you can't call the game in the seventh inning.
I understand.
And I think that's the point. So, this is democracy in action. It's fine. It's good. Let the voters decide. There are plenty of voters out there yet to come. There's still after Pennsylvania, there's still Indiana, there's still Kentucky, there's still North Carolina. Those are all important states. They ought to be able to vote for the candidate they want to vote for, and let us see what happens down the line. Why cutting it short makes some sort of sense for the Democrats in the fall, quite honestly escapes me, whereas the other strategy strikes me as on its face something that's going to hurt the Democratic Party.
Well, I think the answer, Sean Willens, is that none of these contests that they've had there's not a lot of difference between these two candidates, and in the heat of the fray, they've both done damage to each other, and some people argue to the Democrats' chances. And the ABC debate nobody was happy with that, and in fact the ABC themselves have been castigated pretty widely
I can't quite understand why. I didn't think that debate was so bad myself. Other people thought it was ludicrous and horrible and terrible. I don't know. It was more ludicrous and horrible and terrible than when, Tim Russert and company beat up on Hillary Clinton back in October. It's just the knocks that go with things. I don't think it's going to... I don't think, basically, that the contest that's going on today is going to do anything to expose any of the candidates that they wouldn't be hit with in the fall. I mean, if one has the idea that the damage that's being done by Hillary Clinton, let us say, to Barack Obama, is something that the Republicans don't know about and aren't going to spring on him, then they're crazy. I mean, I know how the Republicans operate. They're going to try to do their best to do all of this stuff. It's going to be there. It's going to be there, and it's lurking out there anyway. I actually think it's better to get it out now and let people decide on that basis, and then we'll go forward. But I don't think that we're going to be significantly weakening each other. I think shortening it, however, would weaken the party because it'll leave people feeling as if a true decision wasn't reached.
Well, but if Obama is forced to spend the rest of this campaign talking about the reverent right, then there's no question that McCain will win. I mean, there's the Iraq War. There's the economy.
That depends a lot. That depends on the kind of campaign he mounts. I mean, if he's successful in winning the nomination, then he will have to put to rest those doubts, which he can do. I don't think he's quite done it yet, but he can do it if he's a strong enough candidate, and then move the campaign to where it ought to be on the basic issues. But there's still a lingering doubt about his judgment on these issues, and that's legitimate. But he's the one who can take command of it. It's not up to the media, or to the, what should we say, the lesser angels of our nature. In the end, candidates decide how they're going to run and how campaigns are going to be run. And I think he has a great, he has run a great campaign thus far. He has the ability to do that. He can emerge as a stronger candidate than John McCain if he runs the right kind of campaign.
Well, just in closing, Sean Willenstedt, it seems more and more clear to me that if Hillary Clinton does win the nomination, and she obviously if she does well Tuesday in Pennsylvania, it seems almost inevitable that she'd have to take Obama on the ticket with her, wouldn't she? Just to heal the bitterness that's out there amongst this new crop of young voters that have come up.
Well, I don't know that Senator Obama would accept such an arrangement. So that's all very hypothetical. I think that I think that either of them could win. I think that she has a better chance of winning. In the end, I don't think that vice presidential candidates matter all that much. I think it does matter very much, however, there are many more, positions that a person could have that would be more powerful than the vice presidency. And it would depend on how those different forces get together and what kind of deals they make behind the scenes to ensure that they will have a place at the table should the Democratic candidate defeat John McCain. So I don't know whether it's the vice presidential nomination that really counts so much. I think it's a matter of coming together in all sorts of other ways. I think back to 1980, for example, when Senator Kennedy challenged Jimmy Carter, and there was no love lost. It went right to the convention, and there was no possible rapprochement between the two. I don't think that's going to happen this time. I think that it should move in a very different direction. In 1980, it helped cost Carter the election. It ensured that Ronald Reagan was going to get elected because the party was split. I think the party may have learned something from that. I hope it's learned from that, and we'll find a way to reunite in November. And I don't think that the naming of the nominee is necessarily the most important thing. The vice presidency has enlarged its importance over the years, particularly under with the Clinton-Gore ticket. But it's the vice presidency. As John Nance Garner once said, it's not worth a warm bucket of spit. And he was that's the polite version of what he actually said.
Right, but tell that to Dick Cheney. I understand he's been running the country for the last 7 years.
But I don't think that either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama would allow his presidency to be run roughshod over the way that George W. Bush has.
Right. Well, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Sean.
Take care.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Sean Willens, who's the Dayton Stockton Professor of History and the Director of the Program in American Studies at Princeton University. He's the author, his most recent book is The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln. He wrote a very, very widely read article back in 2006 about the George W. Bush presidency titled The Worst President in History. And he's a supporter of Senator Hillary Clinton in her efforts to become the Democratic nominee for president. I'm now speaking with Francis Kissling, who's a former president of Catholics for Free Choice, an independent organization of progressive Catholics based in Washington, D.C. Under Ms. Kissling's leadership, the CFFC has become a leading force for change on gender, sexuality, and reproduction issues. She was described in Ms. Magazine as the woman who makes the Vatican sweat. She's been a prominent spokesperson for progressive Catholic views at all papal trips to the United States was arrested while demonstrating at the Vatican Embassy during the 1987 papal visit. She's currently a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, where she's writing a book, How to Think About Abortion, Pro-Choice Reflections on Rights and Responsibility. And in the interests of balance, we're not Fox News, but we are fair and balanced. Francis Kissling is a supporter of Barack Obama. What's your sense of this trip? Because obviously the thing that struck me most about this papal visit vis-a-vis the previous ones with the previous pope is how much better this pope's English is. So
yes, definitely.
It's kind of a superficial judgment, but
right.
It does
right.
make a difference.
Well, yes, it does, but I also think that this was a much less polarized trip in terms of criticism of the Pope than this Pope got far less criticism, and there was far less coverage of dissent within the Church during this trip than there had been in any of John Paul's trips to the U.S. And in part, I think it is because this Pope is a less polarizing figure, but also a less charismatic and less popular figure. I mean, he's not unpopular, but he's just not as popular as John Paul was, and he just doesn't attract as anywhere near as much geopolitical attention. And so the focus was quite different. I mean, it does, to me, indicate a decline in papal power in political contexts.
Well, he's, I understood, and he's obviously this visit has had to been forced to deal with the ongoing scandal in the Catholic Church vis-a-vis the child molesting and the enormous payouts that went on, and the lack of transparency, and there's a number of groups that have come up, victims advocacy groups. The theory that always that I'd heard was that the last pope and this current pope, who was the last pope's right hand man in terms of the doctrine, were in denial, that they referred to this as the American problem. Do you think that this Pope Benedictus has managed in that meeting that he had with some of the victims to chart a different course?
I think that he has charted, he went a long way, both in the number of times he referenced the sex abuse scandal, in his acknowledgement that mistakes were made in terms of how it was handled, and in meeting with the victims to ease the feelings of a lot, to take away the sting in the public arena about this, that yes, this was a good thing and he did well with it. For many of the victims, and I do work with particularly the survivor network of those abused by priests, who are the more confrontational group of survivors of priestly abuse, for many of those people, it was still seen very much as window dressing, and particularly because of the lack of acknowledgement of the collusion of higher-ups in the bishops and cardinals, who reassigned priests, who covered up information, etc., that the actual abusers have been castigated by the Pope, and some victims have been welcomed, not any who are confrontational, but that, you know, Cardinal Law from Boston still sits in a cushy job in Rome, with all his rank, with all his privileges, and with all the pomp and circumstances associated with it, in spite of the enormous problems that he created through cover-up. So it's mixed, but I think on the whole he did himself well, but has certainly not satisfied many victims.
And in terms of the financial transparency at the diocese level, because it seems that one of the reasons that this sexual abuse scandal got so out of hand, and what's going on for so many decades under the radar, was because the payouts were kept quiet. And is there any was there any acknowledgement on the part of the Pope that there has to be more input from the parishioners in terms of how their money is spent?
Zero. I think that both the Pope ignored all of the things that relate to what we learned, concrete things we learned from this scandal, and how we have to change, was largely ignored. The only thing he dealt with was that perhaps he will make some changes in canon law so that they can get rid of priests who are pedophiles more quickly and more definitively. But he didn't deal with those things. And the U.S. bishops, who also commented on this situation while the Pope was here, used it as an opportunity to continuously say, the problem is solved, we appointed a committee, we have better procedures, we have rules and regulations, and this doesn't go on anymore, and everything is absolutely fine. Which, of course, everything is not absolutely fine, and systemic, the Pope did not give one inch on papal power or absolutism in terms of financial accountability in parishes or how decisions are made. There's no movement on that.
So, Francis Kissling, do you think that there will be a day when this kind of issues that you try to bring to the fore, which are obviously at direct loggerheads with the current doctrine, particularly mm-hmm. on abortion and reproductive rights. The long and the short of it is that there is apparently a crisis in the church in terms of recruiting priests because of celibacy itself. It appears to be dysfunctional. It appears to also be the result of a decision made about 1,000 years ago where the church didn't want to where priests used to be married. And that they didn't want to have to take care of the widows and orphans, and essentially it became a property issue. Yeah. So it seems to me there are two ways, the most effective and enduring way to fix this problem would be to allow priests to marry and to ordain women as priests. Mm-hmm. Then the abortion issue goes away, because if the priest's daughter gets knocked up, he's going to have to deal with a real situation, not a theoretical one.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
two, if women are priests, instead of being kind of second-class citizens in the church, that would also, I think, go a long way to healing these divisions.
Yes, I think that I've believed for some time now that I will see during my lifetime married male priests. I think that is in the cards. It will take one or two more popes, which doesn't mean that many years down the line, but I would say a decade from now, whoever is pope will be in a position to allow married men to become priests, and will do that. And then I think the next step will be contraception, because once those priests are married and do have wives, the institutional church certainly does not want them having again, going back to what you said about why we changed the rules, that they certainly don't want lots and lots of children of priests to need to be supported by the church. And that's about as far as I can predict. I think that the hostility to women, especially in terms of their exercising priestly power, is terribly strong. And if the other two steps are taken, male married priests and loosening up on contraception, I think that that will satisfy people to a considerable extent for some time. Women priests are much further down the road, and abortion is even further down the road. The other thing, though, I think, is that to some extent, those issues are changing outside of the purview of the church. I mean, some 60-some women have figured out over the past 5 years how to get themselves ordained, and have done so in Europe, Canada, and the United States. And they, even though the church doesn't recognize them, they call themselves Roman Catholic priests, and they have a variety of ministries in chaplaincies, hospitals, private communities, etc. In some ways, you know, I think that that movement will grow as it did in the Episcopal Church. And when it comes to abortion, you know, we all know that Catholic women have as many abortions as do Protestant and Jewish women. In fact, they have more abortions than Protestant and Jewish women. And the Catholics have, to some extent, ignored the church for a long time on this. And because, you know, abortion is something that if a woman needs it, she needs it, you know, once or twice in a lifetime. And you just kind of ignore the church and go about your business. So I think some of those issues have receded from public attention. And the enormous public loss worldwide that the Vatican has faced on the abortion issue is incredible. You just have the European Union, or the Council of Europe, just passed a resolution a few days ago calling on all European states to legalize abortion. Abortion has been legalized in Mexico City and in Colombia, Colombia and Latin America just within the last year or so. And so, you know, the Vatican has really receded in terms of some of its political power on these issues. I think the Catholic moment has passed.
Well, let's since we have you on, and we had Sean Willens on earlier, who you listened to and who is a supporter of Hillary Clinton's, and he was arguing, of course, that she would do better in the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. and that essentially the it should have been a winner-take-all delegate process, and if so, she would be way ahead. Tuesday is going to be significant. There's a possibility that Obama might win. He was looking like, apparently, he got stalled a little bit by this ABC, his momentum got stalled by this ABC debate. But it's still wouldn't be unreasonable to suspect that he might just eke out a narrow victory, but in which case she may have to withdraw. But assuming that the pollsters are right and that she wins by, you know, 5 or so points,
5 to 8%. Yeah.
What do you think she's going to do? Do you think there's a chance she may see the writing on the wall? Because Howard Dean has, on Friday, made a very impassioned speech to the superdelegates saying, now the time for you guys to step up and declare your votes right now, because we've got to end this train wreck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't see Hillary withdrawing before June. I mean, I think she's going to win in Pennsylvania. But I think that, you know, the reality is that when all of the primaries are finished on June 3rd, Obama will still have a significant lead, in terms of electoral pledged delegates, number of states won, and popular vote. I think that's going to hold. And I think that whether or not the superdelegates, I think it's less a question of whether the superdelegates make their decisions early, which I wish they would do, than it is how do these two candidates conduct themselves in this period of time. The problem is not just that we have had, a close battle with two great candidates, so to speak, but the problem is that, and from my perspective as an Obama supporter, that the kind of campaign that Senator Clinton has conducted, which to my way of thinking has been so negative and so vicious against Senator Obama, and I was extremely disturbed in the Pennsylvania debate by this, by the way in which Senator Clinton pounced on the patriotism issue, which I just, you know, felt was abhorrent to me. That it's this kind of campaigning that Howard Dean should be criticizing.
So, but
that's why we need the delegates to make up their mind, because the campaign is so negative.
I understand, but why doesn't he wear a pin? That seems like a no-brainer. Why make that an issue? I mean, I know it's stupid.
Yeah.
In other words, are you twice as patriotic if you wear two flags? I mean, the whole thing is completely absurd. But
it's how. I was looking at the two candidates. I didn't see a pin on Senator Clinton either.
No, but I mean, he's put himself in a hole there.
I agree.
And also that
I agree.
His answer on Iran attacking Israel with a nuclear weapon was really poor. I mean, there's certainly indications that he may not be ready for prime time.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a case of whether he's ready for prime time or not. I think it's a case that, you know, no candidate is perfect. I mean, there are things about Senator Obama's position. I'm not very happy with the way the senator is backtracking on gun control, for example. But as far as I'm concerned, so you can't agree 100% with anyone. But I still think that when it comes right down to it, I think that the way in which he generally is more analytical about political issues than just knee-jerk is important for the country, and I do think, you know, so for me that's a very important quality in that sense. And I was as disturbed by Senator Clinton's opening the, you know, getting herself a bigger beach umbrella and being ready to use military force against Iran if it attacked anybody in the Middle East.
Well, both of them didn't deal with the.
Pretty weak.
Well, but they were also completely off the point, because deterrence, which went on during the Cold War, and there hasn't been a use of a nuclear weapon since Nagasaki. There's a reason for that. That deterrence works, and the idea that, one, the Iranians don't have a nuclear weapon. Two, if they did, if they fired it at Israel, which is the fifth largest nuclear power in the world, they would cease to exist. And assuming in the remote possibility that Israel didn't have the retaliatory capability, which they do have because they even have nuclear submarines with missiles off the Iranian coast, I might add, then maybe there'd be some reason for the United States to consider retaliating. But it's a hypothetical of a hypothetical. And they both got sandbagged, I think.
Yes, I think so. I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right. And I think that to some extent, some of that, I think the 60 minutes or so of pounding on, Bill Ayers, flag pins, right. Reverend Wright, et cetera, threw both of them off their game.
Well, I have to move on to South Africa now,
okay.
Francis, but thank you for so much for joining us.
It was nice to talk to you. I haven't talked to you in a while.
No, it's been a while. And have a lovely day.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking with Frances Kissling, the former president of Catholics for Free Choice, and she's currently a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies at Harvard University. And I'm now speaking with Martin Welts, who is the editor of the monthly investigative journal Noseweek, published in Cape Town, South Africa. The Noseweek broke the story of a Chinese arms shipment bound for Zimbabwe that the South African dock workers refused to unload the ship. And I take it, Martin, that you mentioned in the New York Times, I imagine this has been a big story in South Africa.
It has been a big story. It's been a big story in an odd way, because certain publications, certain areas of our public life have tended to shy away from the story because they find it embarrassing. But others have grasped it with it's been a very empowering experience for civil society in South Africa this past week.
And how did, without giving away sources, how did you come across this this story that these Chinese arms destined for Mugabe's Ministry of Defense from a Chinese company, Polytechnology Inc., which is a state-owned arms company, shipping mortars, mortar tubes, rockets, and assault rifles and ammunition? How did you come across this?
It's quite a touching story, anyway, one of those butterfly's wings stories, with somebody in the shipping industry, a shipping clerk, a clearing agent, having these documents come across his desk. This was last week, Friday, and just having his conscience touched and not knowing what to do, phoning a friend and asking for advice, and the friend saying, well, I don't know what to do either. But then thinking about it over the weekend, and come Monday morning had decided to call our publication, Noseweek, which is very well known in the country as a publication that will take on unpopular causes and publish fearlessly.
And you're in the tradition, right? You're in the tradition of the private eye in England, right?
Of the investigative end of it rather than the satirical end of it.
Right.
Yes, we are not satirical, but we are investigative, and we tend to be irreverent in our writing style, a very democratic one, not having much respect for status.
And how did you fare during the apartheid era?
I personally wasn't involved. We only started in started in 93, thereabouts. Prior to that, we'd run a sort of real summer's that version, sort of out of somebody's garage. But that's sort of prehistory.
Right.
I've been in the investigative business for many years, and yes, I did cover the apartheid era, and very much on the same basis as I do today.
So give us a sense, if you will, Martin Welts, of what the debate now is in South Africa, because this is clearly holding hands with Mugabe has clearly embarrassed Mbeki. Everybody, I think, was deeply disappointed, including some of the African leaders that had met in Zambia to try and solve this problem. And it was widely understood that Mbeki actually was not helping. In fact, he was turning back the clock in terms of efforts on the part of the neighbors to try and stop a meltdown. And now you've got these arms coming in, which could well be used in a brutal crackdown on these poor beleaguered people. So what's the tone now vis-a-vis the leadership and the extent to which the South African people are going to light a fire under their leader?
It's a very peculiar thing because it's really revolves around one man's relationship with Mugabe. And that is President Mbeki of South Africa, who has had a very, very long personal relationship with Mugabe from very early anti-apartheid campaign days. A biography published recently reveals that in his youth already, he was familiar with Mugabe, who started playing at a very early stage pretty well a sort of a fatherly or parental role. And it's explained really in the sense of African culture, the enormous respect held for a senior of the clan or the family, or even if it is by adoption in a sense. So it's suggested that Thabo Mbeki will never contradict or instruct his senior in the form of Mugabe to do anything he might politely suggest to him or ask him. And this is somehow the sort of the explanation of South Africa's so-called policy of quiet diplomacy. It was really that the individual, Mbeki, just couldn't get himself to take a position, but at the same time was very protective of him, where nobody else was. Everybody couldn't wait to be rid of Mugabe. And there's been this bizarre situation now for several years. And it's got worse and worse, obviously.
And what's the position of Mbeki's likely successor, Jacob Zuma, the head of the ANC?
Nothing like the same connection, for a start. Obviously, Zuma's advisors take a much different view. Zuma is also much closer to the trade union movement, the urbanized population. And I think, in addition, if one is going to go for ethnic alliances, which is not necessarily a dominant one, but could undoubtedly play some role, the minority tribe in Zimbabwe, which is very much at the brutal end of Mugabe's heel,
The Matabele tribe, is that?
The Matabele, yes. They are, in fact, direct cousins, of course, of the Zulu, to whom Zuma is a senior member. They were a refugee clan from the Zulus century and a half ago. So the language is the same. There is that attachment. I mean, they might have been seen as rebellious a century and a half ago, but blood is blood.
And Mugabe was responsible for a massacre of the Matabele right in the 80s.
And a continued victimization. So there's no question of it that, you know, there would that be that type of appeal. And then, of course, the people who have suffered most in Zimbabwe as a result of the disintegration of organized society is the urban population. I mean, the rural subsistence population are probably the least affected, but people in the city who are dependent on business, industry, a wage, transport, all those things, of course, are devastated, and those are the main supporters of the opposition. They also have strong alliance with the labor movement in South Africa, which is in the government alliance in South Africa. So it's as I say, they have of late of the past year been openly contradicting the president on his policy, taking a different line, and now they have not only has the president of the party, this is Zuma, now taken a position opposed to Mbeki's, but many senior party officials, down to the Speaker of Parliament, has also assumed a position in contradiction to the president.
And of course it was the labor union that blew the whistle and refused to, or didn't blow the whistle, you blew the whistle, but they decided not to unload this Chinese ship with arms destined for Zimbabwe, although apparently the ship just hauled up anchor and went up to Maputo in Mozambique. So the arms will get to Mugabe, right?
Yeah, there's much that we don't know at this stage yet, but there are certain things are becoming clearer over time, and one of them is a very strong indication that the South African government was implicated in facilitating or arranging this arms shipment probably from the start. there's a lot of evidence that Zimbabwe has been unable to pay for much smaller shipments than this one, and this is not particularly large.
1.245, almost like $1.25 million, right?
Dollars, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, of course, in a country that has no foreign exchange and a 2,000% inflation rate, you know, even that is serious stuff. So, as I say, even smaller shipments didn't make it to Harare simply because they couldn't get the foreign currency to pay. The suggestion now is, also those shipments would routinely have gone via Mozambican ports. This one coming to South Africa, obviously having been paid for in advance, and then also the fact that when local freight agents and shipment trucking companies started pulling out and refusing to actually transport the thing, the state arms company, Arms Corps, stepped forward and said, well, they would organize the transport. That's yet a further indication. And then, of course, on top of that, Mbeki's recent declaration that there is no crisis in Zimbabwe, which is, by the way, a legal precondition for South Africa having given it a transit clearance. We have laws which prohibit the delivery of arms to countries in a state of civil war or unrest or destabilization. So all in all, the plot thickens, and it appears increasingly that the Mbeki government had a heavy hand in all of this.
Well, just in terms of context, though, it's hard for me to understand why the South African government wouldn't have a pragmatic interest in stabilizing Zimbabwe because of the spillover of refugees. What's going on there vis-a-vis the refugees that flood over from Zimbabwe into South Africa?
I think it's a completely chaotic situation. I think nobody knows the exact numbers, although the numbers are evident on the street. So one is very aware that there are a large number of Zimbabweans in South Africa looking for work and so on. But very little official and a complete inability to control the borders anyway. So I think foreigners might have difficulty understanding that although this is very much a democratic society in many, and you know, as witnessed the activities of the last week, which are able to stop this shipment, the government itself, the governing elite, has developed an elite agenda of its own related largely to personal fortunes and so on. And that raises suspicions that very much like how the Zimbabwean elite survives on the profits of mining in Central Africa, in the Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, that there might be the same connections in the South African political elite.
Well, it's pretty clear that Mugabe's coterie of sycophants are in the diamond smuggling business, aren't they?
It's diamonds and a lot more than diamonds. There are many, many valuable minerals that are to be had for the taking in Central Africa right now.
So what are the South African workers, the working class in South Africa, how do they feel about the competition from people flooding over their borders, particularly from Zimbabwe?
I would imagine a growing awareness, a growing politicization. One of the issues, by the way, which probably mobilized the Transport and Allied Workers Union, the dock workers, not to refuse to unload this cargo, is that growing awareness in the union movement that both they have a collegial debt to their colleagues across the border, but similarly their own interests are actually threatened by the flood of refugees.
And I understand one of the paradoxes here is that the refugees that come from Zimbabwe and other African countries are better educated than the local South African workers, many of whom were involved in the anti-apartheid struggle.
Yes, a very serious issue. There's no question of it that the education system that was run under segregated South Africa, apartheid South Africa, offered black citizens a completely third-class education. That regime saw no need to educate black people who were going to be manual laborers anyway. That the whole system not only denied them an education, but it actually denied them the opportunity or to be entrepreneurs or to develop any sort of entrepreneurial culture. Many people don't realize that under apartheid South Africa, black South Africans could not run a business. they were expected to be the customers of white business, not to set up in competition. The result is that we have black South Africa has no culture of entrepreneurship and a generally poor education. There are obviously many exceptions. I'm generalizing. But this means when we are flooded with refugees from Zimbabwe that has had really a top-class education system. And so their level of literacy is much higher. Their urban skills are much better developed. And they, by the way, are not the only immigrants. We have immigrants in all sorts of other African countries that have a culture of trade. So when they arrive, they immediately are entrepreneurial, set up businesses and so on, which these have really antagonized the local population who don't have comparable skills and feel at a terrible disadvantage, to the extent that there's a massive sort of anti-reaction to Somalian traders who have set up shop in South Africa as a survival technique. I mean, they're generally quite poor refugees who have small shops in shanty towns, you know, really shack shops, but they have their shacks burnt down. They're frequently murdered on the basis that they're perceived to be unfair competition.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us from Martin Welson for your investigative reporting that broke this major story. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for your call.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. I was just speaking there with Martin Welson, who's the editor of the monthly investigative journal Noseweek in Cape Town, South Africa. He broke the story on this Chinese shipment of arms to Zimbabwe that the South African dock workers refused to unload. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Lick Duan, the assistant producer.